or I guess I'd prefer to write the G on the other side. And so sometimes when this condition is satisfied, if this condition is satisfied, I usually say, well, this, so some people call psi a generalized solution or of this equation. You might call it a weak star solution. So, in the sense that if I integrate this measure against any test function, I get this measure back. And when psi is smooth, it's actually a bona fide. When psi is smooth and strictly convex, then you actually have a diffeomorphism that gives you a solution of this equation. But my claim, the claim that I made and that I want to use in order to address sort of various geometrical inequalities is that, in fact, this Monge-Ampère equation holds F almost everywhere. If we're careful to interpret, so F should be X should be a Lebesgue point of F. Here, F and G are in L1. Non-negative functions with the same total mass, and i.e. at points x, which are the big points for f, 2 and points where psi has two derivatives in the sense of Alexandrov. Almost everywhere sense, and then it follows that grad psi of x exists and is a Lebesgue point for G. So. So in fact, these three conditions allow you to make sense of all of the terms in this equation in a pointwise way. And I just wanted, the first thing I wanted to do today was talk a little bit more about this theorem of Alexandrov's that says convex functions are differentiable twice almost everywhere. So actually what you really care about is that the gradient of psi be differentiable. So x naught is in So what I mean by this is that there exists an n by n matrix P such that, well, I would like to write something. I'd like to write a sort of Taylor theorem. I would like to write gradient psi of x minus gradient psi of x naught minus P of x minus x naught is small. And the only problem is that this thing may not exist. So I'd like to write that this is little o of x minus x naught as x goes to x naught. And so I need to replace this term here with this the sup of the subdifferentials. And it's a little lemma that follows from this definition that the function, not only is the first derivative having a first order Taylor expansion, but the function is and psi convex. That the function is having a, what do you call it, a second order Taylor expansion. So this is the definition. So first of all, I mean the Alexandrov almost everywhere sense, and this is the definition of what it means. And in this case, this matrix P, actually, these two things are equivalent for psi convex. These two things are equivalent. And we write so we call this matrix P the second derivative in the sense of Alexandrov. Does it answer your question? So, in other words, psi is twice differentiable at x naught in the sense of Alexandrov if I can write some first order tape. First of all, it has to be differentiable. The gradient has to be unique and single valued, exist and be single valued. And secondly, I need to be able to write a second order Taylor expansion, which is good to terms which are lower order. And so this is, of course, a subset of the domain of gradient psi, which in turn is a subset of the set of points where psi is finite. And so the theorem. So Alexandrov's theorem is the domain of the second derivative of psi has full measure in the set of points where psi is finite. I've got it backwards. So I look at all points where psi is finite. I take away the points where psi is twice differentiable, and what I have left is a set of zero volume. And so I thought that I would do a proof of this theorem of Alexandrov. So there's a really lovely proof, which. This is not Alexandrov's proof convex. Other questions? So this is an analog of Lebesgue's theorem in one dimension, which says that a non-decreasing function is differentiable almost everywhere. This is n-dimensional analog of Lebesgue's theorem. And there's a really lovely proof in a paper by Ambrogio and Alberti based on a theorem of Minty's. So this proof is only a few years old. and the based on an idea from Minty. So Alexandrov proved this, I guess, in the 30s or so, approximately 33. And I guess Minty's observation probably comes from the mid-60s. And the observation of Minty is that the ingredients in the proof, so it's Minty's observation plus Rademacher's theorem, which says that a Lipschitz function is differentiable almost everywhere, plus the area formula from geometric measure theory, for example, from Evans and Variety's book. And so let me show you the idea of the proof in the context of Lebesgue's theorem. So Lebesgue's theorem says that whenever you have a function which is non-decreasing, except possibly for some jump, I mean, it's non-decreasing, it may have some jump increases and so forth. If you take a picture like this, this is a function y of x, and you rotate by 45 degrees, and so you write this as a function v of u, then in the VU space, what you see is a function that's Lipschitz with constant 1. Well, it may not be defined everywhere, but you can extend it to a function which is Lipschitz with constant 1. And so this thing is differentiable almost everywhere by Rademacher's theorem. And so that means that in the original picture, at almost every point on this curve, you have a unique tangent line. And as long as the slope of this tangent line is finite, that means that y has a derivative as a function of x. There is a set of zero measure here where this thing is not differentiable, and that lifts to a set of Hausdorff measure, zero one-dimensional Hausdorff measure on this curve, and the projection down to the line doesn't increase the length of any set, so that the set of non-differentiabilities projects to a set of measure zero, and the only thing to worry about is that the points where the slope is infinite also have to, we hope that those points also project to a set of measure zero. And that's where the area formula comes into play. So the area formula. Used to show points where has a vertical tangent. I mean, for example, here's a whole set of positive length, but it projects to a point. Project to a set of measure zero on the x-axis. And so let me remind you of the area formula. That's dated by Evans and Garapi. So. If F so if I have a Lipschitz mapping between two copies, two Euclidean spaces, and M should be less than M, then and A sits in Rn, measurable, that if I integrate the Jacobian of the transformation F at, I guess I call it U, with respect to n-dimensional measure, over this set A down here in the domain, then what I will get is basically the integral over f of A, the n-dimensional Hausdorff measure of the image. And the only thing is that I haven't assumed that f is 1-to-1, and so it's possible that f takes A and it folds it over several times on the image, and so I need to write the number of pre-images here, the number of U belonging to A intersect F inverse of X. Okay, so this is a version of the area formula. And in the case N equals M, which is the case we're going to, so the Jacobian of F is some algebraic thing related to the partial derivatives of F, or some geometrical thing related to how F linearizes almost everywhere because it's a Lipschitz map. And so you would have some rectangular matrix here, and you multiply it times its transpose, and then that gives you a square matrix, and you take the determinant, you take the square root, that's the Jacobian. But in the case we're going to apply it, N equals M, then the Jacobian is simply the determinant of the derivative of F, and it's defined almost everywhere by Rademacher's theorem again. So, okay. So somehow this idea looks a little bit one-dimensional, and so it's a source of, I think it's kind of remarkable that it works equally well in n dimensions. What's that? So I'm about to tell you what Minty's idea was. So here is Minty's lemma. So of course we know that the subdifferential of psi viewed as a set in Rn cross Rn is cyclically monotone. And so it's monotone a fortiori. A fortiori, it satisfies the following definition. This is called sometimes called two cyclical monotonicity. Two cyclically monotone. If for every pair of points, the inner product of the change in x with the change in y is non-negative. And so Minty's observation so there's an important change of coordinates, which is inspired by that one up there. So let's let u be x plus y over root 2, and v be y minus x over root 2. So it follows that x is u minus v over root 2, and y is u plus v over root 2. And then if and only if. So this is a monotone set if and only if M if what I want to say is M is contained in the graph of a Lipschitz 1 function V over U. And so M should be contained in a graph of the form U minus VU over root 2 U plus VU over root 2, where the Lipschitz 1 function. In other words, the distance between v of u1 and v of u2 is always less than the distance between u1 and u2. So that was Minty's idea. And so for x and y, and x prime and y prime, from Rn cross Rn, define uv and u prime and v as above, then two times the change in v is given by the change in y minus the change in x squared. The root 2 comes out and cancels this one in from these formulas. And so the minus sign here generates a minus sign here. And the plus sign in the definition of u generates a plus sign here. Right, so this is delta y squared minus 2 delta y delta x plus delta x squared. This is delta y squared plus 2 delta y delta x. Plus delta x squared. And so the difference between these two things actually maybe I want u first u minus u squared minus b prime minus b squared is equal to this minus that would be 4, but because I've divided by 2, I guess 2 of delta y delta x. And so in particular, if I'm a monotone set, this is non-negative, and that says v is less, the change in v is less than the change in u. If now if x, y, and x prime and that says, in particular, that if the change in u is 0, the change in v has to be 0. So there's a well-defined function v, which is defined on some subset of u and Rn. And and it's one Lipschitz. Defined on some subset. Such that M is contained in this graph. Minus U over root 2, U plus VU over root 2. Such that u is in capital U. And I can always extend this to all of Rn by Kirze-Bronz theorem. Conversely, in the xy coordinates. Has the property that, well, the left-hand side here is positive, and so the change in y times the change in x must also be positive. It's monotone. Somehow simple. And so now an immediate corollary of Rademacher's theorem is that so what's the first corollary? Here's a Lipschitz. Some manifold of Rn. Right, because the mapping U goes to U comma V gives a Lipschitz bijection. Rn, I should have said it's a subset, M monotone each M monotone lies in a Lipschitz submanifold dimension n in R2n, since U gives a Lipschitz bijection. From Rn to graph to G covering M. Right, I can write this thing as a Lipschitz graph over this diagonal. So in other words, U. And then because of this and Rademacher's theorem, Lipschitz submanifold G has a tangent space some dimensional at UVU for almost every U in Rn. And since this mapping here gives a bi-Lipschitz correspondence, that means i.e. Hn almost everywhere on G. And so somehow we would like now to come back from saying that this thing that snakes through here has a tangent space Hn almost everywhere to if we take the bad points where it doesn't have a tangent space, that's a set of n dimensional Hausdorff measure 0, we project that down to the first copy of Rn. Projection can only decrease the one dimensional Hausdorff measure of the thing, so the projection also has a measure 0. Okay, so now we're sort of moving into the proof of Alexandrov's theorem. So we want to apply Minty's trick to the monotone set, which is this thing here. Yes. Yes. So there would be an analogous definition, but you would have to change. So let me put a dot here to remind myself that this is the subdifferential. If I wanted a definition for concave functions, I would need to put the dot upstairs to remind myself that this should be the superdifferential. you could... So one thing you can do is you can restrict your attention to the points where psi is actually differentiable. But then you have to be careful because it won't do what you want it to do. So... I mean, I can make up a definition of second differentiability that works for Lipschitz functions just by saying, okay, I disregard all the points where the derivative is undefined, and then I ask for the derivative to have a Taylor expansion of first order. And then if it does, I say the function is twice differentiable. One of the problems with doing this is that you will not have this equivalent if psi is merely Lipschitz. In other words, for the function to have a second-order Taylor expansion, it's probably sufficient but not necessary that the derivative has a first-order Taylor expansion. And so... Right. Or at least semi-convex. I mean... So the function plus a large multiple of x squared should be convex. So, I mean, convexity is a little bit special because I've assumed d2 psi x is bigger than 0 everywhere. And you can probably replace this with a negative constant and still have all the nice properties of convex functions. So if psi is c11, if you have constants below and above, then psi is c11. If you only have a constant below, then you have kind of one-sided C11. That's called semi-convexity. And sort of everything I want to do works fine for semi-convex functions or for semi-concave functions. But it doesn't work so well for functions for which the second derivative can become unbounded in both directions. Other questions? So... okay, so I have this, so what's the situation? I have this map, identity cross V, which takes Rn to G, and this is by Lipschitz. And then I also have the mapping, I have the projection map. Which takes x, y to x, and this is a one Lipschitz map. And so I can call, let me call pi g the restriction of pi to g. And so this may be a many-to-one map, but this is also Lipschitz. And So, I should say I'm cheating slightly because in between here and here is this funny coordinate rotation. So there's this mapping phi that takes u and v to x and y, basically, where x was, I think, was it u minus v? X was u minus v. This is an isometry. Phi is an isometry on Rn, and in particular. So this is also 1-to-1 and onto. And so what do I want to say? Yes, so I have two bases for Rn, the uv basis and the xy basis. And this map here is taking values in Rn in the uv basis, and this one brings it into the xy basis. So maybe I should call this G1 and G2, I guess. But G1 and G2 are the same manifold, simply represented in different coordinates. Or maybe I should call, I'll call it GU and GX or something. Okay, G1 and G2 is fine. And so I really mean G prime here. So I guess the first thing is that the set of points where V fails to be differentiable down here under all of these Lipschitz maps yields a set of points of measure 0 over here, since it was measure 0 over here. So elsewhere. G prime has a good tangent space. But possibly vertical, but possibly with infinite slope. Relative to x. And so I need to control, I need to show, so this is one small bad set. And there's some other set, namely those points where I have infinite slope relative to x, and I need to show that the projection under G of that bad set is also 0. And still need to show. So if I had a decent notation for this, that would be good. so what does it mean to have infinite slope? It means that the tangent space includes vectors orthogonal to Rn, to the base space. Projects to a subset of lower dimension. And so what did I have? Yes, right. The claim is that this set of points here exactly corresponds to its phi of UVU such that the Jacobian at U of H equals 0. Where H is this composition here. Pi G prime composed with phi of UVU. And, yep. V is this Lipschitz function defined on all of Rn, whose graph covers G, which covers, whose graph G covers this monotone set. Two N arguments. Right. Sorry, so I'm missing one more map. So this map ID cross V should be in here as well. In fact, what I mean is H. So let me, where I have this H in mind here. And this should be a function of U only. So H is the composition of this map, with this map, with this map. Yes, H is the composition of the map that takes a point here to a point in the plane, then rotates that point by 45 degrees, and then projects it down to here. And so the point is that H is made up of a mapping that's bi-Lipschitz, composed with a mapping that's isometry, and an isometry and therefore bi-Lipschitz, composed with a mapping that's Lipschitz. And so the only way that its derivative can be non-zero, I mean, can be zero, so the derivative of this is always non-zero because it's bi-Lipschitz, the derivative of this is always non-zero because it's bi-Lipschitz, and the only way that H can have zero derivative is if this thing has zero derivative. And that happens precisely at those points where the tangent line is contains vectors orthogonal to the horizontal space. And so that's actually this thing here. So if the tangent space projects to a subset of full dimension in Rn, so in other words, if I have all my slopes are finite, then the differential of this map is full rank, and since the differential of this map and this map are also full rank, I get a full rank map from Rn to Rn. And if if that's not the case, then the differential of this map has rank less than n, and so the composition of all these things gives me a map that takes an n-dimensional space onto a lower dimensional space, and that's precisely when the Jacobian vanishes. Because so there's the derivative of the map, id cross v, which takes Rn to the tangent space to G. This is 1 to 1 and onto. And then there's another 1 to 1 and onto map, which is d phi, so the tangent space to G prime. And then there's this map, which is the derivative of the projection map. And either this is full rank, in which case I have a full rank mapping, linear map from Rn to Rn, and the Jacobian is non-zero, and the tangent space projects onto a full set, or this has less than full rank, in which case the Jacobian is zero, and that exactly means the tangent space projects down to a subset of lower dimension. Has full rank. If and only if d pi g prime does. And so now I'm in a position to apply the area formula. So let U naught, or I guess A, be the set of those U such that phi of U of du belongs to this dangerous set N. And apply the area formula to this mapping H. And so the area formula is the integral over A of the determinant of the derivative of H is equal to, with M equals N, is equal to the actually, I want to intersect this with, well, let me not worry about that yet. Is equal to the number of points U in A intersect H inverse of U, and then integrated with respect to n-dimensional measure on, that should have been H inverse of X, huh? Something like this. And so the only one, so somehow I want this number to be not too large, and so I want to know that right. In fact, I never have a problem with this. So I'm suddenly worried about this being larger than 1. There's some reason why it can't be larger than 1. So let's see how the argument's supposed to end. The argument's supposed to end like this. And then on this set A, which this is contained in the set of U such that Jacobian U of H equals 0. In fact, it's supposed to be equal to this set. And so this, the left-hand side, this is the Jacobian of H and U, so the left-hand side is 0, and that's supposed to tell me that the volume of the set of bad points is also equal to 0. And so I'm just hitching on this point, which I had a good answer to last night. And okay. And so 0 would be a problem, right? Exactly. Yes, okay, good, thanks. All right, so somehow this is the step that always confuses me, or it took me a long time to sort out what's going on in this step. Even in one dimension, it's a little bit ugly. You can do it by a covering argument in one, by a Vitali covering argument in one dimension. But. And somehow, the other thing that confuses me is I tend to do this transformation in my head. And I only made it explicit now as I was done. Okay, so I guess this is a good time for a break. So what I'm going to do in the second half is I will return to... I basically want to show that these transportation distances define metrics on measures. So I wanted to start thinking about the geometry of the space of probability measures where the distance between two measures is metrized by how cheaply you can transport one onto the other. And length space structure of that. Okay.
I need to the derivative that I'm looking for. is actually the inverse of this map, not the inverse of the composition.
Then we can start to say the same thing. Only this wouldn't be the area of the same thing.
No, it's not. That's what I'm saying. It's not the inverse of this. It's composed with that. It's just the inverse of this.
Then you get a matrix code to change the coordinate.
Oh, you say it's pretty good.
Sure. back to back when I was doing this last night. So the problem, one of my problems is this one I did mentally last night. I didn't have it at all. Because I did the change recording between G and G last night. Then I was explaining it. When I said this, I thought, gee, someone may call me on this and say that, you know, I don't want to take this thing and project it to the first coordinate.
Yeah. I wouldn't call you that because I knew exactly what you meant.
Okay. Yeah, the problem is that I often know exactly what I mean, but I'm not so sure that I everyone else. Because I have a picture in mind and it doesn't say what you
mean. But I think you drew.
That's right. So Craig Evans once told me that the world was divided into two groups of people, those who knew Alexandros' theorem and those who didn't.
I wonder
how many other such similar divisions there were. But I also sat beside Craig in a lecture in Oberwolfach once, and I said, oh yeah, Alexandros' theorem is really just Rademacher's theorem, and he said, no it isn't. And then... And then I showed him this thing in one dimension, and he said, does this work in higher dimensions? And I said, yes. And he said, amazing. So. I don't know. It appears in a pretty long paper of Alexandros, which I have never tried to penetrate. In fact, possibly, I'm not even sure it's translated. I have it. It's about 80 pages in Russian. It perhaps is not the only thing in that. And there is a proof also in Evans and Griepy, but I don't really care for it very much. The proof in Evans and Griepy is that psi has a second derivative in the distributional sense. And that thing is a positive symmetric matrix valued measure. And then the thing that we want is the absolutely continuous part of that. So in that sense, it's clear that the thing we want exists as an abstract object, but it doesn't help, it's not a very helpful, it's far from showing that it satisfies the definition that I gave. In other words, that the gradient can be approximated by it, and that's what you really want, at least what I really want when I apply the thing. And this proof, of course I didn't even show that today, but this proof is much, much closer to doing that. I think it's sort of plausible from this proof that it does. Because, I mean, one of the things that's nice about this proof is that you're really working direct, you're not working with the function, you're working with the gradient already. And so you're showing the gradient has an approximation, which is a much stronger statement than saying that the function has a second order approximation. So maybe I should make two remarks. The first remark is I didn't really connect this very clearly with the derivative, the second derivative of the function psi, but the derivative I'm looking for is actually the inverse of this map here. And so as long as this map doesn't have zero Jacobian, I can invert it. And the second derivative of psi at x naught is d pi g prime inverse at x naught comma grad psi of x naught. And the other comment that I should make is that convexity is very important because if I take a function like this, it also has a second-order Taylor expansion at the origin, but it's far from being twice differentiable. And so convexity is what prevents this kind of thing from happening. So what I really have in mind here is I guess x squared sine 1 over x has a second order Taylor expansion at 0, but its first derivative fails to have a derivative. And this kind of thing can't happen if you have a convex function. Such counterexamples. Don't exist among convex functions. Than that might fail to be continuous. Yeah, so, right. Okay, so maybe it's too crude, but somehow there are horrible things that can go wrong if you're not in a class of semi-convex or if you don't have some kind of geometrical control on the function. And so what I said before was that I like this proof because it deals with the derivative, which is the more sensitive thing, rather than dealing with the function, like the proof in Evans and Garaipi does. Okay, so I wanted to switch gears and talk about metrics on probability measures. I guess I should say transportation metrics or something. And what I have in mind is defining a distance as the pth root of the nth of so this is sometimes called the Kantorowicz-Rubinstein-Wasserstein, and it has various other people's names attached to it as well. LP metric on the set of probability measures on RN in this case. it doesn't matter particularly that I'm working on Rn. I can also replace them. Rn in the Euclidean distance by a metric space. I don't know, complete separable metric space. And I sometimes, so this is Polanyi's notation, I sometimes will use the notation dp. And the claim is that this thing is a metric. And it's pretty clear that it's symmetric under interchange of mu and nu, because this is symmetric under interchange of x and y. And I guess because this is non-negative except at x equals y, it's pretty clear that this will, and since this infimum is attained, it's pretty clear that if this min is 0, then gamma is concentrated on the diagonal, which means mu has to equal nu. And so the only tricky part is showing that it satisfies the triangle inequality. And there's a nice lemma that shows this. And so so Villani calls this the gluing lemma. I've also heard it, I think I've heard it called Strassen's theorem. And he gives various references. It's really, you might also call it a compatibility lemma for generating measures with different marginals. So I want to let, I want to look at some measures, probability measures on three copies of Rn. But in general, these could be compact Hausdorff spaces. Rn is, of course, not compact, but the non-compact case follows as a corollary. And if I have a gamma with, it's an extension lemma, if I have the gamma with marginals mu1 and mu2, and a gamma 2, 3 with marginals mu2 and mu3, then there exists an extension gamma 1, 2, 3 on the triple product. Such that it projects onto the first pair to this measure. And it projects onto the second pair of spaces and gives the second measure, where pi 1, 2 of x, y, z is x, y, and pi 2, 3 of x, y, z is y, z. So I have these two measures. The first one is a measure on this product. The second one is a measure on this product. And there's a compatibility condition, namely that the right marginal of this measure coincides with the left marginal of that measure. So when I project either of these two guys all the way down to x2, I see the same measure mu2. And then the claim is I can find a triple measure on the product of all three spaces such that if I project onto the first two variables, I see this one, and if I project onto the last two variables, I see that one. And this is exactly what I need to satisfy to show that the triangle inequality holds, because this thing here is, if I bring the piece root inside, I see that this is the minimum over gamma, and mu nu of, if I look at the function of two variables x, y, and I take its LP norm with respect to gamma, and then I do a minimum, that's the P-Wasserstein metric. Aside from this compactness bit, so let gamma 1, 2 be the minimum of over measures with joint. Let gamma ij. Achieve the minimum of measures with marginals mu I and mu j of the LP norm. X I cross X j d gamma. And then I know that the Wasserstein p distance between mu 1 and mu 3 would be so it's equal to some min, and so let gamma 1, 2, 3 be from the lemma, have marginals gamma 1, 2 equals pi 1, 2 of gamma 1, 2, 3, and gamma 2, 3 and then if I define define gamma tilde to be the projection onto the variables 1 and 3 of gamma 1, 2, 3, then this will be the left marginal of this thing here is mu 1, and so that means the projection of the triple measure onto the first thing has measure mu 1. The right marginal of this is mu 3, and so the projection of this thing onto the third variable has marginal mu 3. And so this gamma tilde will be a competitor in the minimization that determines the Wasserstein distance between mu 1 and mu 3. And so this is less than or equal to I guess I have some confusion about whether I'm working in a metric space or Rn. Now, this function depends only on two variables, but I can think of it as a function depending on three variables, x, y, and z, which happens to be independent of y. And so that's, so I can integrate it over the triple product if I want to. And then I'd be integrating with respect to gamma 1, 2, 3. And this being an LP space satisfies Minkowski's inequality. So the thing inside is a positive function. So the triangle inequality says that that's less than dxy plus dxyz. And then Minkowski's inequality allows me to separate this into a sum. I'll do it over there. In other words, this is the norm on functions. But again, this is independent of the z variable, and so I can write this as an integral over just the double product, x1 cross x2, and the 1, 2 marginal of gamma 1, 2, 3 is gamma 1, 2, and this is an integral over x2 cross x3, and this was, since these were minimizers, this is the Wasserstein P distance between mu1 and mu2, and this is the Wasserstein P distance between mu2 and mu3. So somehow the triangle inequality is completely straightforward after we have this lemma, and the lemma is a little bit of work. Well, the lemma is the Hahn-Banach theorem, but with a little bit of work. So there. Other questions? So I want to this is a vector subspace. And I claim that F is a closed subspace, closed in the supernorm. It's a little bit helpful. So the problem with working with this thing is there's lots of ways of representing a given function h of x, y, and z as a sum of two functions f of x, y, and g of y, z, because any function of y that I add to this I can subtract from that. And so without lots of generality, replace fix some point. Replace f of xy by f of xy minus f of x naught y and g of xy by g of xy plus f of x naught y, so that so I can always do some repression like this. And then I still get all of F. And now let's keep the lemma. Thank you. if Fn plus Gn converges to H in soup norm, I can basically argue that i.e. Fn plus Gn is Cauchy. So for every epsilon, there exists n such that nm bigger than n imply something like this is yz and yz. Is less than epsilon, so in fact, if I write this on the other side, I fix a point x naught, and so this is a function of y only, and I subtract this function from f and I add it to g. That's all. Thanks. And no, I'm just trying to prove the claim. Maybe I shouldn't even argue it, but so I'm just trying to claim that S is actually a closed subspace. And I only invoke this normalization to see that F is closed. And the point is that the left-hand side here is a function which is independent of Z, and the right-hand side is a function which depends on X, but only a little bit. So what I want to argue is that actually, if the sequence Fn plus Gn is Cauchy, then Fn itself is Cauchy and Gn itself is Cauchy. And this needn't be true unless I make this normalization. Because I could keep adding some crazy n-dependent function of y to F and G to ruin the Cauchiness unless I make some kind of normalization like this. Right, so if I evaluate this at two points, z1 and z2, and I subtract this equality at z1 from the analogous inequality at z2, then so since this side is independent of Z, that implies that GM minus GN at YZ1 minus GM minus GN YZ2 is less than 2 epsilon. So this side would cancel out entirely. I'm left with this, the difference between this at two different points. And similarly, I could play the same game with the Fs. So Fm minus Fn at x1, y minus Fm minus Fn at x2, y is less than 2 epsilon. Yep. Right, so take x2 to be x0. Fantastic. Yep. Great. And but also if I take x2 to be, so if I take x to be x0 here, then I get the g as a Cauchy sequence. And if I take x to be x0, well, I guess one if I take x to be x0 here, then I also have that f is a Cauchy sequence, and so now they're both Cauchy. So both so taking x equals x0 here and taking x2 to be x0 kills this term, and that implies both fn and gn are Cauchy. And so that says that these two things have separate limits of xy plus uniform limits. And that says that H is, again, a sum of two things that look like this. So S is indeed a closed subset, much to the surprise of no one. And so the idea is to use the Hahn-Banach theorem to extend. We know how we want to define gamma 1, 2, 3 on S. And we want to extend it to all gamma 1, 2, and gamma 2, 3 are given, and so I want gamma tilde on a sum to be the integral of f against gamma 1, 2 plus the integral of g against gamma 2, 3. And notice that this is well defined. Since if f plus g is equal to f prime plus g prime, then I have that f minus f prime, which is a function of x and y, is equal to g prime minus g, which is a function of y and z. So this is a function of, must be independent of x, since this is, and this function must be independent of z, since that is, and so this is some function k of y. And therefore, whatever gamma 1, 2 of f would be equal to gamma 1, 2 of f prime plus mu 2 of k, and gamma 2, 3 of g would be equal to gamma 2, 3 of g prime minus mu 2 k, since the left marginal of this guy is the right marginal of that guy. It's mu 2 in both cases. And so this is also equal to gamma 1, 2 of f prime plus gamma 2, 3 of g prime, whenever this holds, because these two things cancel out. And so this is a well-defined linear functional. And I claim that the norm of this thing as an element of the dual space is equal to 1. And so if you grant me this claim for the moment, then now extend Hanmana. Extends gamma tilde to a measure gamma on, well, it's a linear functional on x1 cross x2 cross x3, but it's every linear functional can be represented as integral with respect to some measure by Riesz-Markov. And Borel, whatever. And it's since such that gamma agrees with gamma restricted to S agrees with gamma tilde. And this condition here implies that the first projection of gamma 1, 2, 3 is what we want. And the second projection, the second and third projection of gamma 1, 2, 3 is again the second given measure. And Hanmanic allows you to do this preserving the norm. Should still equal 1 as an element of the dual space. And that's, by the way, the sum of the positive and negative parts. And so if we check that the positive part has mass 1, then the negative part will have to be 0. So I'm using x cubed as an abbreviation for this. Sorry, this thing here is equal to gamma 1, 2 of x1 cross x2, and that's equal to 1. So these two numbers sum to 1, and these two numbers differ by 1, and that says the second one is 0 and the first one is 1. So this linear functional comes from not just a signed measure, but in fact a non-negative measure. And it has mass 1, and so that puts it in the correct space. And I think that I've checked everything except this claim here. I'm a little bit out of time, so I guess I will just give you a hint for the claim and then leave it for homework. So the point of this claim is, again, it's a question of choosing the right representation of a sum f and g. Actually, maybe I have enough time. So the claim says that f plus g in f can always be rewritten as f prime plus g prime in S, so that the soup norm of F plus G is actually equal. So this is on the triple space is equal to the soup norm on X1 cross X2 of F prime plus so I have to do this first. And if I can do this, then I see that assuming this, I see that gamma tilde of F plus G is equal to gamma 1, 2 of F prime plus gamma 2, 3 of G prime, which is less than 1 times soup norm of F prime plus soup norm, 1 times the soup norm of G prime. And if I've done this correctly, then this is F plus G. And so if I put absolute values on this, I get that. And so that shows that, in fact, the claim is less than or equal to 1. That would show this with an inequality here. And the fact that gamma 1, so on the other hand, also, gamma tilde of 1 is equal to gamma 1, 2 of x1 cross x2, which is equal to 1. And so I get equality here, and so that shows that this is equal. And so this is the part that I'm leaving for homework. And the other bit of homework is that I proved this for compact metric spaces x1, x2, and x3. And corollary, the same follows for non-compact Hausdorff spaces. Y1, Y2, and Y3 by applying this lemma to the one-point compactifications. So I define a new topological space, which is the old topological space union a single point. The open sets here are the same as the open sets there if they don't contain infinity. And if a set over here contains infinity, it's open if and only if its complement in Y is compact. And maybe I should have said, I don't know, what do I need, locally compact or something? Whatever the hypothesis is such that the one-point compactification is a nice topological space, and then the whole thing goes through, and so that's how you get this for Rn. You have to show that when you do the lemma, you get a measure which is supported on these expanded spaces, but actually because gamma 1, 2 and gamma 2, 3 have no mass at infinity, the measure gamma 1, 2, 3 that you find isn't going to have any mass at you have infinity in three different directions now, but it's not going to have any mass on any of the infinities. Max? Right. Every measure, okay, so it's a real measure because, so there's a real version of the Hahn-Banach theorem. So I extend it using the real Hahn-Banach theorem, I get a real measure. And so a real measure can always be written as a difference between a positive part and a negative part, which are mutually singular. And when I do that, the total mass of the mass of the positive part plus the mass of the negative part is actually the norm of the measure viewed as linear functional. And on the other hand, other questions? Okay. So actually these metric spaces have a beautiful structure. Not only are they sort of abstract metric spaces, but they have geodesics in them. And the geodesics come from solving the transportation problem, and so that we'll start to talk about that next class, the geodesics. So that these are somehow, at least in P=2, there's some evidence that you can think of this thing as being some kind of infinite dimensional Riemannian manifold. For P≠2, it's less clear. I guess it's probably some kind of Finsler manifold. So you can start to look at evolution along geodesics in these metric spaces, and that's where the geometrical inequalities that I'm going to talk about will come from.